Okay, I'm happy to be able to introduce Andre. Andre was born and raised in New York City. He worked in his family business for 25 years and retired to turn his attention to writing. He has a doctorate in comparative literature and lives in New York City with his wife, Anne, and are parents of three grown sons. Andre is our current president here at the Gloucester Writers Center. Yeah. And he's also the director of the Maud Olson Library. I was searching around looking for stuff on Andre, and I found this great thing that he wrote himself, so I'm going to read your own stuff here, man. Yeah, all right. Andre writes about coming to Gloucester. I remember clearly coming to Gloucester for the first time in the spring of 1996 and being welcomed to dinner by Ralph Maud at the Gloucester House, where he sat at a table with several other people who, like me, had come to spend a few days on his peripatetic tour of Charles Olson's Gloucester. While I don't entirely remember or understand what happened in the 20 years between then and now, the initial encounter was the beginning of a chain of events that culminated just a few weeks ago, in the installation of the library dedicated to the Ralph Maud collection of Charles Olson's books. Just a couple houses down the street from here, 108 East Main. I think it's safe to say that I look forward to visiting Gloucester of Charles Olson under the guidance of Ralph, who was a preeminent Olson scholar, as a means of orienting myself, getting my bearings at a complicated juncture in my life as I was emerging from my postdoctorate cross currents of my research of comparatist in the disciplines of literature and archaeology, living with my wife in lower Manhattan and three sons under the age of 12, including twins, and contending with my work in the Greek-American shipping business as a player in a multi-generational partnership between two families, an asymmetrical partnership that was breaking apart under acrimonious circumstances. All of this together was taking its toll on me as I struggled also to maintain a standing commitment as a writer and a poet in the field of so-called radical poetics. So that's how Andre came to Gloucester, but he'll tell you later what's transpired. Andre calls his website Pangea Press, which gives an indication of his particular interests. Pangea, of course, the supercontinent that existed during the Paleozoic era, the era after Olson's Gondwana land. And check out his site if you and who knows, you may hear some bird songs of the Mesozoic. Like Olson, Spears is a digger looking for evidence of what is said. Last year he traveled to Persia, home of the world's oldest continuous major civilization. It's like something like 4000 BC. He was interested in getting a look for himself at what interested Olson as well as Henry Corbin. And I don't know, maybe he'll pass some of that stuff on tonight. We'll have to wait and see. Andre's the author of a short epic that is pronounced Zoe. Yes. Okay. Zoe, a tale of the New Atlantis. His published works in progress include Letters from Mu, Part 1, Year 2000, Fragments from Mu, a sequel, The Nexus of Evil, Late Fragments 1 through 7. He calls this work epistolary verse fiction. In addition to this, his work, he has collaborated with French artist Jean-Marc Scanray on artist books Lost in Space and United States. Here, Annie and I have been talking, there's this sort of idea that we love, and we think it encompasses kind of the writer's center. It's this, the idea of memory and imagination being kind of the same things going in different directions. And when I read Andre's stuff, I get a sense of that. He gets the reader beyond the confines of our present reality to contemplate memories of the past with possibilities of the future. And poet Andrew Joran put it simply. He said, Spears is an ecstatic poet peddling ferociously towards the ancient future. Andre Spears.
Yeah, thank you. So I have to say first, well, this is fantastic. You know, I don't think I've read to this many people before, and they're all from Gloucester, which is amazing. It's just amazing. I don't know how this happened. I want to say it's absolutely wonderful being here in this place. I've stayed here 3-4 nights, and it's a beautiful, it's a labor of love, and certainly Annie Thomas and Henry have put their hearts and souls into making this place so hospitable to writers. You know, it's a comfortable room. The vibe of Vincent Farini is strong here. The Maud Olson Library is just down the street, and I urge you to go see it. It's Ralph Maud created this, and it's amazing that it's down the street. And of course, the harbor of Gloucester, right? It's a wonderful writer's retreat, a very special place. In fact, it's so special that it's actually hard to get any writing done. But that's a different issue. So it's really a thrill to be here, and it's to see, you know, how far it's come and what it is, and really, you two guys just, you really made it special. I'm going to read from Work in Progress. I've been working on this for a long time, sort of on and off. To make it easy, I'm going to start from the beginning. This is a little bit of an odd work. I'm going to start from the beginning so not to have to set it up. I'm going to read some stuff that goes back to the early 80s. It's a work of, and then I'm going to cut. I'm going to cut forward. So this is a work of fiction, somewhere in between poetry and prose. It's a hybrid or an experimental mix. It's essentially, as Henry said, an exchange of letters between a man and a woman, two voices, husband and wife. And it's set in the lost continent of Mu. So these letters go back and forth. The framing device involves the so-called trump cards of the major tarot, of the tarot deck, the major arcana. I don't know if you're familiar with the sequence of 22 cards. So the first, I'm going to read the first three chapters, and then I'm going to jump to what I'm writing now. And the first three chapters are the cards corresponding to the fool, the magician, and what I call the seeress, which is the priestess. The high priestess, and I associate these chapters not only with these trump cards, but with letters of the Greek alphabet, so alpha, beta, gamma. So I'm going to read the first three, then I'm going to jump to what my work now, which is the third card, 13, death. So alpha, the fool. I speak about 35 minutes. My love, it was at this same time in a distant past that we first mourned our beloved child, S. Then as now, Delta, Neutron, and Platex were aligned in the sign of the cross eye. Colors brightened and sadness touched our souls. How well I remember this brilliant red sky and the sea so glossy white. If the porno continues to blow as it has, even with their nirvana against us, we should be reaching the waters of Taurus in 6 days. The crew's morale, for the most part, is holding up well, although Don Juan, the chief mate, was recently seized with madness and jumped over the side, screaming. Two prayer flags were flown in remembrance, Sun number 9 and Chow number 33. Our link up with the Indian fleet seems likely to occur in the Georgian Sea. There is still no explanation for the sudden alien presence in the Orionis ripple. Latest readings from the SS Maru, the Byzantine scout vessel furthest afar of our forces, indicate that the alien ships are engaged in what appears to be a defensive maneuver. Their armada presents four different fronts, equal in length, positioned along two lines. These lines, according to the SS Maru, bisect each other and continue to revolve in opposite directions, periodically forming a single row. Other reports claim the ships are equipped with oars as well as sails. Intelligence is divided on this matter. Tarzan believes such findings to be true, but Venus and Maria, her colleagues, disagree. With a growing sense that fate is deep at work, my love becomes stronger. the memory returns of our time together by Panama Crater on the eve of the last new age. I hope to read you soon. Your wife, S. Beta, the magician. Dear S, no sooner were you off at sea than phantoms came to visit me wearing skeleton costumes and masks. What? No cool buttocks to pet but your own, they'd say, and puff on cigarettes. I sent them away with a three-fingered curse, but the knot in my heart quickly tightened. The signs have arrived that tell of new times. Since your departure for the Orionis Ripple, events have followed a disturbing course. The youth, especially, have been causing alarm. They flaunt their nakedness. They take to the streets in unruly gangs where they strike obscene poses and scream. No longer sweet-tempered and dear to behold, they perform masturbation while uttering poems. They dance on the Sabbath, euphoric and wild, cursing their parents and sages, declaring themselves masters of the last word. The youth of Valium, long famed for the beauty of their rear ends, are making more havoc than most. Their leader is an arrogant boy by the name of McDonald's, whose sex is said to be high all the time. Invoking the theme of violent green freeze, he calls for an order based on their law and exhorts his companions to riot. Though little is known of their ultimate goals, they gather on beaches in secret groups and wait for new youth to rise from the sea. It remains to be seen if this practice will spread, nor is it clear if the new arrivals conspire in a larger scheme. Everywhere, their number is increasing, as is their beauty. According to rumor, the initiation of youth is now taking place on a clandestine basis. More troubling still, the few initiations held of late have met with odd results, a development lending support to the view that outsiders are tampering with mysteries of the flesh. It was only recently that I saw the problem firsthand. I had lost 19 shares playing cards at a saloon called Le Joie de Vivre and was on my way to the wetlands. Near Marienbad, I reached the temple where a crowd had gathered and the rites had just begun. In keeping with custom, the associate officer read from the Book of Jiminy, while the assistant officers poured bottles of sparkling water into a large basin lined with mosaic. Family and close friends looked down from a balcony, while off to one side a fiddler and piper created a dreamlike sound through the ongoing patterns they played. At first, nothing unusual marked the proceedings. The lovers waited in separate chambers at opposite ends of the hall, remaining unseen till the pool was full and the music had stopped. Then they came into view and began their approach. He, Kirkor by name, handsome, tall, and able-bodied, she, Sumela, equally fine, with healthy breasts and a slender waist. Walking in step, they reached a halt and stood face to face with the water between them. The priestess and priest followed next, blessing them with incense. Before they'd even embraced, there was an ominous sign. When Kirkor and Sumela entered the water, its sparkle went flat. They immersed themselves nonetheless, ignoring the trouble. As soon as their bodies made contact, the water was fizzing once more. Foreplay, however, took no time at all, and the water quickly came to a boil. Propped up against the side of the basin, the girl encircling the boy with her legs, they heaved and panted intensely without respite, venting their passion at a frantic pace. It was only a little while later that smoke began to appear. In a matter of moments, it thickened into a velvety cloud that poured from the basin, forming a strange mass from which long strands were escaping. The lovers, hidden from view and letting out wild cries of rapture, were near the height of their enjoyment when a ghastly sound ripped the air. Climax came almost at once, with a billow of smoke so huge that it plunged the whole room in a fog. There was silence while the haze slowly dispersed. The tension kept building until all eyes were fixed on the site where this odd event had occurred and where the last of the smoke hovered like a large bubble. Finally, out of the pool stepped a dark man with a thin mustache. He surveyed his surroundings with an air of indifference, then stood with his arms crossed. In the usual manner, after having been offered a towel, the man was told of his previous form as the maiden Sumela. He showed little response, occasionally glancing to and fro. His wife was slow to follow. She was ugly and squat, with short, fair hair and fair skin. She moved awkwardly, making her way out of the water and coming up next to the man. She was welcomed as a sage, reborn of Kirkor, after which the two of them stood surrounded by silence, he beginning to fidget, she timidly looking around. The bundles were then brought forth, six in all. It was a rare case, part of southern tradition, when for reasons unknown a leprosarium offers both initiates an extra choice. They were thus presented with three bundles each, and the woman was asked to choose her clothing first. Confused and hesitant, she pointed to the bundle on her right, which is found to contain a T-shirt and jeans. After dressing to general applause, she said nothing, but stared at the floor and sucked on her fingers. Then the man exclaimed it was his turn to choose. He wanted the bundle on the left and signaled to have it undone. It contained a uniform, matching shirt, pants, and a visored hat, plus a belt onto which was fastened some sort of club, a sinister stick, not straight, but curved in shape, rounded and smooth at the end. He put on the clothes and, raising his arms in a gesture of greeting, announced that his name was Monroe. He honored thereafter the dictates of custom, thanking the congregation, although a certain unnaturalness about him was peculiar. Before leaving, Monroe declared his joy on becoming a sage, then turned and kissed his wife. The woman's name, he added, is Lee. As they walked from the temple, the husband went first with a swaggering air while his barefooted wife wobbled along, following him at a distance. They continued down to the valley toward the Silicon lagoons. The common feature that seemed to mark them was in their eyes. Neither Lee nor Monroe, upon coming to life, had the colorless eyes of youth, but despite their color, they appeared dull and less than human. No light shone from within. According to H. Ecologicus, the proconsul, this was an unfavorable omen. The emergence of sages like Lee and Monroe, with their shallow gaze and deviant manner, seems to coincide with another development that I learned about from Pleiades. We were in Le Rendezvous, a saloon where the ouzo is excellent and card players gather. During our talk, Pleiades told me that he had recently noticed on a statue of Armstrong, overlooking Beirut, a small glowing object stuck to the side of her neck. More are being discovered, although I have not seen them. Solid and round and soft to the touch, they are often spotted on ceilings or walls, hidden or just out of reach, yet of their origins or the means by which they stay fixed, nothing is known. They may be able to travel. For the mythologists, these mysterious beads are tears, the tears of Atlas filtering into our land, though whether they stem from her joy or her sorrow is unknown. Between the recent quirks in nature's order and an alien fleet on the far reaches of the sea looms the specter of death. That we, as parents, should find our thoughts turning to the memory of one we loved so completely makes conditions more painful. What failed in us then, when the idea took hold that our child would never be seen or heard from again, seems now to have its echo in the world. The truth, regardless of whether S fell in the limbo abyss or the ones at Eden or Ur, is that together we have gone on, and our world will go on, despite the unpromising signs. I wait to hear from you. Your lover, A. Gamma, the Seeress. Dear A, we have crossed the waters of Taurus and are sailing unto parts of the sea and traveled since the time of our ancestors. I think of you often. You are my only refuge from the fear that I feel as we venture so far from home. The alien nature of our surroundings, however subtle, is unmistakable. The sky seems almost violent in its redness. The sea looks different too, its surface more active, as if stirred by wilder forces. Even the stars are more fiery. The aura of strangeness, as well as the fear felt by the crew, are not likely to last, but judging from our recent transit, a hazardous course lies ahead. Of immediate concern to me as navigator is the tension between Möbius, the mapper, and Occam, the weatherwoman. Both are still novices, having served for just a few journeys. Tempers began to rise as we were nearing the Omega Line and about to go past the Maya Whirlpool. The quarrel between them involved the issue of a port versus starboard approach. Occam argued for starboard, on the grounds that the wind was more dependable and the chance of meteors not as great. Möbius, on the other hand, maintained that the charts for a starboard approach were by now obsolete. I refer the dispute to the captain, who sided with Occam. There is still disagreement regarding what happened. We kept close to the Omega Line, sailing alongside it. As we entered the pass, with the whirlpool virtually behind us, an easy crossing seemed assured. Yet suddenly, as if by a will of its own, the ship veered away and turned back toward the whirlpool. All attempts to alter our course seemed hopeless. We started to circle, slowly at first, then faster and faster. For one frightful round, we were trapped on the edge of that hole when, as unexpectedly as before, the ship made an abrupt turn, breaking free. We went straight toward the pass, propelled by the force of the water, and soon after were heading onto the open sea. No harm befell either ship or crew to the credit of Anna O, and Van Rubik proved her worth at the helm. Furthermore, as I explained to the captain, our data files showed that the northwest quadrant and pass 11 especially were optimal under the circumstances. Möbius and Occam, however, are not on speaking terms. I hope they resolve their differences soon. The crew's morale otherwise seems all right, and in this respect, credit must go to Avon, one of the new recruits. She serves as the ship's poetess. On several occasions recently, as the best constellation Bigfoot was rising, Avon has inspired us with her verse. She recites in a rich, exotic voice, usually to the accompaniment of claves. She's able to span all the moods. Wonder, courage, laughter, and love are those she most often returns to, but there are times when she achieves peace of mind, evoking all of them at once. With the exception of the commander, who is yet to leave his cabin, everyone gathers on deck when Avon works her art. There has been no news from either intelligence or communications regarding the other fleets or the alien armada. This is not unexpected and represents, according to the files, a transitional out-of-sync phase between inner and outer wavelengths. As soon as contact is reestablished, our surroundings should take on new life and their beauty will increase. I was alone on the forecastle deck just a while ago when a shooting star fell overhead, and the echo it made seemed as clear to me, as pure and profound as the red of the sky or the whiteness of the sea. I felt the delight of continual pleasure fulfilling me, consuming me down to the bone until the sea, the sky, the silence were there again, returning me to my solitude. I miss you and want you, and I know that our hearts are forever as one. Love, S. So I'm going to jump ahead now to current work. This is from Psy, Death. I'm going to pick up exactly where I left off last year at this time when I read with Mike Bond. And what I'm going to read has been published in the magazine that he and Kent Johnson edit online, Dispatches from the Poetry Wars. Put it under the title Ship of State, Parts 1 and 2. Within the action here, there's been a huge battle between this alliance and these aliens, from which, it's a cataclysm, from which only this ship survives, the ship on which S is the navigator. Specifically now, so they're in this strange part of the ocean, so this astral dimension of the ocean. And specifically, they've been going toward a light on the horizon, and for various reasons, the captain gives the order to turn around. So, sigh, Death. Like the charismatic Lady Tongue, whose thick and laughing speech dispelled winged sphinx curse over the land between Ixtlan and Eden, Captain Anna O gave the order to turn the ship around. Although there is still general agreement that Anna O's fateful decision to reverse course was correct, the consequences of that decision were not good. The logic that best explains the mutiny of Woodstock, Greenwich, and Soho centers on the phallic pillar of seawater that poured from the miraculous faucet floating in midair and presupposes the exposure of ship and crew to ocean's lethal content after the weird weather event that blew the large cloud of sea spray our way. Indeed, the collision's impact on the ship's crystal body left a line of demarcation that replicates across the deck from bow to stern the coastline of Yonaguni, as first seen through the eyes of Andrea Diva on the SS Easterland in Skylark's 1001 Argonaut poems. Decrypted crystal vision of mythic shores, in conjunction with which the blue-red haze suspended overhead like a rhizomatic cloud seemed to offer an unfathomable analog map. When they later realized with hindsight that Greenwich, Soho, and Woodstock had been at the front of the seawater's impact zone, Venus and Tarzan, the remaining intelligence officers after Maria's death, explained that first contact with the faucet's windswept stream cast the mutineers as phantom observers of the 16 trump card landmarks on a poematic seaboard that was always already sealing their fate. From the rainbow wheel of Cope above the lost Tower of Pei by the hanging gardens of Meme at the foot of Mount Persepolis, hill of the Hierophant, to the lover's leap on either side of the Giza Rider abyss, to the clashing rocks of justice and judgment, and the column of Aha, the big-nosed hermit from New Yazidi. It was Captain Anna O's order to turn about after the deaths of Maria, Lenigan, Mazuka, Finnegan, Fiat, Mead, that set Greenwich, Soho, Woodstock on their own death track. The 180-degree change of direction that would put the light on the horizon behind us revealed itself to be more overdetermined than imagined, multiplying the physical quanta whose continued observation and measurement pointed the whole crew to the figure of stupid writ large. The doubts, mysteries, uncertainties raised by the unfolding spectacle of death's encryption of the hull were compounded by snafu conditions at sea that justified my decision as navigator to engage automatic pilot as soon as the U-turn was ordered. We were sailing into three separate headwinds. One, a mild, fair yin wind at 2 o'clock, like the Ishmael, the Lemuel, or the Sam that filled the flying jib, the jib, and the stunsail. Two, a hot, high yang wind at 10 o'clock, like the Oksig Skub that engaged the central and left-hand papyrus columns. Three, a cold, light wind at 12 o'clock, like the Sharyar that made the flying buttresses shiver. Three headwinds that blew concurrently against a violent, icy tailwind like the cane in Balaam and Laman's abridged explorations of the pyramid wilderness. Together, they formed a fourfold crosswind force field, whose epicenter was located behind the foremast above the radar, the application gallery, the hydropath, and the stratocaster, and seemed to correspond to the nexus of she he who weeps, she he who praises, she he who mourns, she he who wails in Wawa's Orientalist Guide to Magical Thinking. Moreover, in combination with the churning, rising waters of a larboard current that carried us forward, and an equally strong starboard current that pushed us back, the ecologic forces acting on the ship, winds plus currents as a synergetic whole greater than the sum of its parts, suggested the outline of a peace symbol, facing backward as seen from above, but forward as seen from the luminescence on the horizon, that marked the ship as we advanced, and framed Kogunome, spirit of the keel, as crucified hangman at 12 manic 1 talks on the Jefferson plane of the zodiac cycle. I am saying what I believe on the basis of Article 184 in the Episcopal Charter from the navigation plates of historian prophetess the Marquise of O. And what is, I, navigator, see with certainty, and what is not, I will do if I must, because since that time I have felt the void, but I refuse to throw myself into the void, even if, between a blue-red haze that hovered overhead and a collective big fart that still haunts the ship, I was fooled by a powerful illusion in all I saw. And while I thought I refused first fact, I know now I was refusing the void, because I understand that first fact is not, and I know how it is not. And what I have suffered from since opting for automatic pilot is to have denied the void always already within me, within Woodstock, Greenwich, and Soho, within the dead of engineering whose place they were ordered to take, within Möbius, for whose dormant body they chanted, all of them, spirit companions meant to enlighten me in the ways of the void, and who I refused to be enlightened by until the mutiny of the void played itself out, as in the memory theater of Arnaud, from password to printer to remote control. The silver seas were dim and dull on our curved and narrow path as we veered through starboard shadows, keel to breakers, struggling through one wave as the next one tossed us backward half as far as we progressed. The lights holding steady, their us in the buoy hatch, swaying to and fro, and the pendulum on the quarterdeck leaning sideways, as on the Argo, when Bliney braved Deucalion's flood after the Amazon campaign, in Kulchev's book on useless books, useless study, and useless wishing. We came into a whirlwind at 45 degrees, the sky opened wide, and the parking space split open, as on the Kismet, in Orphic's Tale of the Tribe, when the angels stepped aside, and we found ourselves sailing parallel to the luminous horizon. Our new heading drew closer as we glided on a cord, like the ether rod that guided King Tahiti on the Worm across the great middle sea, quote, from Troynovant to Botany Bay, unquote, through the fiery arabesques of sparkling water that resisted our will to change, to go on, despite all, until our wake was arrow straight, the light behind us at last, and there was silence, prehistoric and hyperreal, returning us to ourselves like the skin of nail on the celestial bodies of the Amduat's crew, as per Brunel and Morel in the median days before the long count, deep and beautiful silence. Then a burst of sound, like the Duquesne whistle cut short, plunged us all into dreamtime. I was part of the first wave in the crew's three-phase awakening from dreamtime, when Captain Anna O ordered Soho, then Greenwich, and Woodstock, our emergency substitute crew for the dead of engineering, to initiate the remote control and turn off automatic pilot ASAP, because the crystal ship continued to swerve in a starboard loop and was coming full circle, reheaded toward the light on the horizon. Soho responded immediately, her face shining like he who cuts with his face in the posterior analytics of the histriomatrix by Ananke, the eunuch slave, and tried to locate the remote control beyond the step stool, the air pump, and the hammock, between the narrow gate and the Magdeburg jars, down the seven steps to the heavy metal cage, from which began to emanate the gurgling sound of Gaga fluid in the Baba hole. And I, navigator, could tell that after the collective search to find the missing remote control in order to stop automatic pilot and reset our course away from the light, mutiny would follow. Because in my dream, I was a flaming vortex, curing myself of a remote control that was making me struggle to exist as navigator, taking all the ethos, logos, and pathos I had, in the same way that Soho, then Greenwich, and finally Woodstock, from what I recognized, were struggling to resist the forms with which the polyencephalic illusion of being first, second, and third substitute engineers clothed their reality and continued to function as that which flowed forth in our replacement world. I, navigator, will stop henceforth being deluded. I have a body which suffers this ship and disgorges reality. I will be done with the action of the sea, which makes me invoke what I deny and deny what I invoke. It was the total input from the dreams of those of us who woke up first that led to Woodstock's moment of crisis, after Woodstock remembered having dreamed of books on fire under the mammon panel, after Greenwich, in her dream, heard the sound of blood from the restless Sea of Nod west of Eden and searched for the remote control of the Kalashnikov console where Woodstock was stationed, after Woodstock left the Kalashnikov console and went to where Soho had searched for the remote control, down the seven steps, to the heavy metal cage, along the Redeemer axis, received in a dream from the Bataclan boys, by the melting ice of Ecbatan. As the ship returned on its ineluctable heading toward the light, a sevenfold backlash of repressed anger due to the continued failure to find the remote control and turn off automatic pilot led to a period of mixture, during which, in their bid to help find the missing remote, our other shipmates, of those who woke up first, transferred their visionary dreams onto the psychological chimera in the waiting room of the Shiite gardens. In keeping with the Spartan protocols of the Realpolitik Institute for Arrière-Garde Studies, they held hands and blew proskynetic kisses at the bulkheads like the princes of Araby on the Paris and the virgins of Lahore, the total effects of which combined to momentarily arrest Woodstock in a freeze frame. Then Woodstock fell into crisis, gesticulating madly during an obsessive-compulsive post-visionary recital of the 72 ways to curse the darkness from Dido's Methodics. After curse number one against the poetics of darkness, Kodak, the second mate, who had dreamed he was midway on the path from Aleppo to Damascus in search of a new Judeca, projected his future body as supplemental fourth engineer and went to calm Woodstock down, explaining that the missing remote would inevitably manifest its fate as light spatter on the time landscape of the minor domination. Similarly, when Woodstock was at curse number 11 against the oubliette of darkness, Sinbad and Tarzan, who both awoke terrified in the secret passageway to the Queen's bicameral quarters, he, Sinbad, from a dream of laughing to death at a cash machine, she, Tarzan, of trying to pay taxes on a pleasure-pain scale from old media, progressed to their future bodies as supplemental fifth and sixth engineers and exhorted Woodstock to stop in the name of love before the power of nothing. Woodstock cursed on. At curse number 14 against the chocolateness of darkness, Vico, who woke up with a mutant gift of seeing around corners, Bismarck on anchor watch, who managed while dreaming to lose the ship's anchor to the sea, and Ringo, who got instantly fat dreaming of an undiscovered leak aboard ship, proceeded toward their being as supplemental 7th, 8th, and 9th engineers. In a fateful twist, they wrestled Woodstock to the ground between the large collapse and the suspended upside-down body of unconscious Möbius, at the very moment of stupor when, to the sound of rocks on the ocean's floor being torn beneath the hull, the ship was violently shaken, and the three of them found themselves wrestling Cowabunga instead, as if Cowabunga, during the actuation of his archetypal emergence as supplemental 10th engineer, had traveled in a spiral waltz through the dense time of his dream to take Woodstock's place, while Woodstock, now completely calmed down, was over by the Mammon panel, where the remote control was hiding in plain sight on the mantelpiece, between the spinning rainbow disc of Zorro and the logbook. Despite its eventual recovery, for the 10 replacement engineers, the traumatic experience of the remote control's temporary loss had henceforth been written on the corners of their eyes with the proverbial needle of Mithridas. Having passed through the successive emanations of engineer intelligence, they seemed predisposed to hold the rest of us who were awake as scapegoats for the debacle. Commander Espress, Venus, the interpreter of his spit, Captain Anna O, and myself. A cruel irony, because I, Navigator, like them, the 10 engineers, knew that it had to be ended. A final wrenching away from the pelagic order of things had to happen. I can no longer deal with this primordial hypostasis within me, this being that is not being, because as it advances, I fall into the gap this same order of things is always already negating. And to make matters worse, the last post on the logbook indicated that the password to unlock the remote control from its hermetic seal was incorrect. Thank you. Voilà. Party's over.
Shipping, did you ever spend any time on the
on ships?
Open ocean?
Yeah. Yes. Long story.
Well, you seem to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And fragments come across as having, you know, some kind of mythological ancestry. But I don't know where I am.
Good, good.
I'm lost without my remote.
It's work in progress.
Of course.
And furthermore, I'm going back. You know, there's two strands to this. There's the male letters and the female letters, so to speak. And I basically pursued the female letters, the woman would see. Corresponds to a card. So when I say I'm at the death card, it's not like I just got there. I actually finished the other series. I mean, it's, you know, really it should be heard as a back and forth. And am going back now to finish the.
How many parts are to come, or was this in fact?
I have about five parts left, and there's depends. You know, there's 22, 24, 26, depending how you want to look at it. So I have five. I have five cards left.
Well, as I said, you know what you're doing, but.
I got to do it.
You got to do it, right?
Indeed. Inshallah.
It's impressive that you've mastered this so that for you there's a sense of coherence and consistency among the various references as they come up. That's what I meant.
Well, you know, Henry mentioned that I'd been to Iran recently, and the reference here in this last thing with the engineers is sort of a, I don't want to call it a take or a spoof, of Henry Corbin's description of the of Ismailic gnosis, this mystical Shiite body of writing, these récits in French, which I guess is a recital, it's a bad translation,
right?
Where the third angel, time and space, open up in this. Vision of the cosmos when the third angel suddenly becomes aware. There are three angels. In fact, in this system, there's an infinite progression of even God has an angel, and it never ends. And it's just one angel after another. And we all have a guardian angel, and this guardian angel is a guardian angel. And the idea is to, and so this original scene, this primal scene involves the third angel becoming aware, and in becoming aware, creates space and time, and gets thrown back to becoming the tenth angel. It's beautiful stuff. Corbin's stuff's beautiful, and it's inspiring. You know, so that was what was going on in that last part I read. I'm just sort of riffing on this text, from Corbin. That was very. Then I got to it through Olson. That was very important. It was important to Olson. Olson's one of the first poets to bring Corbin into the. Into the American picture.
Metaphysical poetry of Averroes is what I know best.
Yes, well, sure.
Back through Corbin.
Yes.
And that would lend itself also to the idea of an ocean voyage to Ultima Thule.
There are plenty of, in these récits, there are plenty of ocean voyages. Mystic journeys to islands, to places where people find God and then just have to come back and live in then with this longing, this nostalgia, which is so prevalent in so much of this body of work, Shiite work.
The charming part to me is you go over various mountain ranges. Some are so attractive.
Yes.
Seductive, that you want to just stay there forever.
Yeah, it's the journey of the soul. I mean, or autopoiesis. Yeah, that's what. It's just, you know, yeah. It's quite beautiful. The other series involves the actual card game. I can read. I don't know if you want me to read one more chapter. What do you feel about that? You want to see another thing? Let me. You want to go to number four? I went 1, 2, 3. Because these texts, early texts, go way back, huh? So I jumped. I could jump forward, but I could, if you want, you know, 5-10 minutes, read chapter 4.
So we heard 1 and 2?
No, I read 1, 2, 3, and then I skipped to 13. And I'm going to go back to 4 if you want, to give you an idea of what's involved with this other series, The Male Voice. Is this okay? You want?
Yeah.
question. You talked about a red sea, a white sea, and a red sky.
Yes, yes.
So then I was shifting that. And then a lot of the names, although not really anymore knowing the cultures, it was Occam and Venus.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Going
yeah.
back and forth, many different cultures, many different
yeah.
names.
Well, I like to have fun with these names, yeah.
Yeah, so...
you know, it's supposed to be very funny, really.
Oh.
It's supposed to be funny.
I mean, I've gotten as far as Flash Gordon, you know, when I was a kid. I love that, but...
I mean, you know, what's this about? It's about people freaking out because they can't find the remote control. It's going to be about people freaking out with a printer that doesn't work. And then with, you know, this is, I mean, if you can step back, I mean, it's funny and it isn't. But.
It's human.
I guess, yeah.
Well, would you compare your invocation of Mu to Nate Mackey's?
To whose?
Nate
Mackey. And that's an interesting question. No. We just happen to be writing on the same thing. Very different work. I mean, you know, yes and no. Yes and no. We just both, we're both inspired by the same piece of music, Don Cherry's Mu, Parts 1 and 2.
Okay.
I don't think he ever, I don't know if he ever crossed his mind that, and probably did eventually, but that Mu is also a Zen concept. Someone asked Buddha, do dogs have consciousness? And the answer was Mu, which is, you know, I mean, you know, it's a non-answer. That's another meaning of Mu. It's a, you know, totally different, and it's of course the middle letter of the Greek alphabet. That's one reason I associate these things with. Let me read. You'll get a better sense of what the other half of this is like. That's for all intents and purposes finished. This should take more than 10 minutes. Delta, the queen. My love, I imagine contained in my heart a teardrop that revolves on a tautly drawn thread. Pierced through its center, it ceaselessly turns. I write by the yew trees of Saxe and Zildjian, such memories come to life, of a time when our love was new, and S, not yet of the world, not yet absent from it. But I find myself haunted now by an added sense of grief, for I recently witnessed a death. It was at Le Carte Blanche in Alcatraz province, beside the Burkini Abyss. I like the ouzo they serve, fruity and rich in aroma, drier than at Trompe-l'œil, but less dry than at Le Déjà Vu nearby. The sight is as beautiful as ever, especially the contrast it offers between the shadows below and the open sky overhead, with the sea barely visible in the distance. Because the saloon is spacious and perched on a hill, the monochrome there has a finer quality, one I prefer since it tends to soften color in the opponent's eyes. About 20 people were present, including Sophia, Psyche, and Bridget, with whom I was seated, plus others whose names you may recognize. Ahab, Freytag, Ramus, and Gungarub, Mbario, Rachter, Thought. The four of us were off to the right, by the window, talking. Rumors are plentiful. You hardly know what to believe. There are stories of rampant madness, phantoms with sexes and angels in the flesh, cash machines up in flames, whole leprosariums empty. For my part, I had never observed a death at cards, but have heard of several recent ones, and this with no taxes due until the Freemason's day. What I saw will always be with me, like a scar. I remember the sudden blank expression on the faces around me, the silence, the rattling of the glasses on the tables. The players in question, two big fat men, both of them bald, were at the back of the room by a large mirror on the other side of the bar. The one who had bet $1 and won wore slippers and a robe. His name was Ku. His opponent, Judd, in an undershirt and trousers, sat motionless, staring at the table. By the time the others and I approached, it was clear that he was lost. As for the cards, there were five left, arranged in the shape of a cross. The seven in the first row were gone, and in the second row, only the middle cards remained. It was the Queen of Spades. Along the third row was the five, the four, and the three of hearts. In the fourth row was the King of Spades. The wagers, they say, were high from the start. Judd had made the opening move. Quiet and slumped in his chair like some true-to-life statue, the man looked unreal, a huge, useless thing on which was stuck a haggard face. In the matter of a short while, with everyone gathered nearby, Judd showed the first symptom, sweat. It formed in small patches on his brow, his scalp, under his nose, and broke into larger drops that coursed down his face and neck. More drops followed, together with tears that flowed from his stunned eyes, before long continuous streams of tears and sweat were pouring down his head, drenching him and dripping onto the floor. His gaze was unflinching, his body paralyzed, then came a twitch in his lip. Infrequent at first, it took on a life of its own, until a new twitch occurred, in one eye, then in both. It was as if the parts of his face were being touched by a terrible current. While his eyes kept blinking wildly, his mouth, his cheeks, and his ears were seized by a series of spasms. The tears and sweat receded. Finally, his entire head started to tremble, and what remained of the sweat turned into smoke. When the smoke had passed, he let out a scream. During his scream, the figures on the cards faded and eventually vanished. His mouth yawned, and out came his tongue, darting from side to side to the sound of a hum in his throat. The new cards appeared, the devil above, the moon, the star, the sun across the middle, the devil reversed below. He fell silent again, his face as blank as before, his body motionless. Tragic and dreamlike, Judd's doom unfolded on the table. First, the star turned into the universe reversed. Next came the simultaneous change of the devil into the aeon reversed and the devil reversed into the God's house. Once underway, the changes never stopped. With the arrival of death, Judd showed new signs of life, and a pattern emerged. After a long period of silence, he exclaimed, "Suck, suck," the war cry, and "Remember," the sharp smiles. He started weeping and mumbling to himself, and all at once the five cards showed the Fool. Overcome by grief and confusion, often babbling incomprehensibly, he continued to weep while the cards in unison turned blank, then into the Fool, then blank, repeating the process dozens of times. Then the Magician came up, announcing the start of Judd's final agony. The cards followed in succession, turning blank each time in between. Seized with terror, Judd described a beast, part human and part machine, walking toward him with a limp. As the cards pursued their course and the beast drew near, Judd became obsessed by the mask it wore, a mask shaped like a Y that was screwed to its nose. He shouted, "No, no, no," as number 10, the Wheel of Fortune, came and went. With number 12, the Hangman, his fear reached its peak. "It's turning upside down," he screamed. In his final utterance, he described a huge, long tooth and ping-pong balls for eyes with toothpicks through them. He began to laugh and fell off his chair onto the floor. Five copies of Death, number 13, were in place. As the cards turned blank again, the laughter gave way to coughing. His face swelled and grew dark. When death reversed suddenly appeared, his body stiffened, his eyes bulged, and he fell flat on his back, letting out a long squeal, a last faint cry, and then silence. Judd was dead. The cards on the table were blank. Despite the horror of what we had witnessed, a sense of relief came over the room. In due course, the figures returned to the cards, the King of Spades, Queen of Spades, the Three Hearts. Patches of ice developed here and there. Nature was taking over. The various patches spread and proceeded to merge, coating Judd's body with a thin film that gradually thickened into a block. He remained encased for some time, his features indistinguishable. I stood by only as long as it took for the shit to manifest. It first began to show through in the regions of his forehead, belly, and knees, small dark clusters beneath the ice, growing as if coming to life. Judd's total transformation into shit was slow, according to thought. 3 days later, the ice was still melting. To no one's surprise, the saloon lies already abandoned. There is one further detail I should mention. The bartender at La Carte Blanche a woman by the name of Mazda, was a former essentialist who had just turned liquidationist. Liquidationists, like Gestanoans and pataphysicians, consider the nature and ultimate fate of shit undecidable. Such ironies currently seem the rule. Not only has the incidence of death by fear reached extraordinary proportions, but most cases reveal a pattern of sorts. In the suburbs of Occident, for example, only saloons associated with continuists, asymmetrists, and cleanheads have been affected, three schools with a shared belief that the aura of shit decreases but never disappears. In the province of Neum, where triumphalists and neo-alarmists predominate, death has occurred in all the saloons save for two, Le Raison d'être and Le Fait Accompli, both of which have strong Harmelodian ties. There are other examples just as bizarre. The fact remains that death has struck nearly everywhere. That profound forces are at work can no longer be doubted. So I wait, remembering you, desiring you. Your husband, A. So that's the other sequence. This guy playing a card game and that card game. So you have a card game with a break in it before the game, and then what happens once he's in this wager, this $1 wager that puts him in a different dimension. And similarly, the woman has this battle with aliens and puts her in a different dimension.
There seems a big stylistic disjunction between, say, number four and death.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's
because of the time of writing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Furthermore, yeah, you bet it's the time of writing. So that's one part. Part one, and then say part two. Furthermore, one reason I decided to skip, since I'm doing a male voice and a female voice, is to go back after years. I'm a different person. I sound different. I think different. So it's a way of giving the woman sort of a different voice from the man. If I'd written them just like that, basically it's my voice, still my voice, but it's two points in time, you know?
It's got to be psychologized. When I think of a 14-year-old male, I think about endless jokes about shit, and as that is part of the humor here, I sense that kind of...
Yeah, glee. Yes, there's certainly an amount of glee. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain glee in just playing with names. I like doing that, you know. Yeah, it is. I mean, maybe it doesn't sound that funny when I read it like this.
No, this is definitely funny. Yeah,
playful. Mm. I mean, there's some. Yeah, I mean, sure. Also, with time, maybe it's gotten more serious. I mean, this goes back to the early 80s.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots come down.